Welcome to the Money Miss podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you. Today we return to Canada. And having interviewed Ontario teachers as part of our first Super Allocator series, we wanted to explore the other immense pool of Canadian capital, CPP, the Canada Pension Plan, established in 1965. And in this interview, we've sought out one of the most well-known and successful women in private equity, someone who's also proving to be a huge role model for girls pursuing careers in the investment industry. Anecdotally, on attending the University of Seoul, South Korea, she was asked why she wanted to pursue a degree in economics, as it had nothing to do with finding a suitable husband. Suyi, how did you reply?
I was ready for all the questions, as you can imagine, for the interview, but I wasn't ready for that. So my first reaction was, why not? And then I saw the professor's face kind of freezing, and I instantly thought that, oh, maybe I have made a mistake. So I was very sad coming out. But then as the professor said, I couldn't find any suitable husband in Korea. I married Canadian, Chinese. And then it's been the best deal ever that I have ever closed, which is my marriage.
Fantastic. Well, that's a really nice way to start. And I think we're going to, you know, blend in, weave in a little bit of that Korean perspective as we go along, because we've had nobody on the show, despite having a fantastic series of guests from all over the world and audience. We have listeners in Korea, but we haven't had anybody who was born in Korea. So let's just talk about Korean education, highly educated country. And is education viewed almost with religious fervor because of its importance?
Korea is called also the economic miracle in the world. So I don't know whether you know, after the Korean War in 1950s and 60s, was one of the poorest country in the world. And from there to where the country has gotten to the developed stage, I think that's all from hard work that people have done. When you look at the country, it doesn't come with wealth of resources. Actually, there's not even a drop of oil coming out of that country. Very little resources. It was all driven by people's hard work again. So education, as you can imagine, is the fundamental for, you know, having very talented people to be able to bring that value add to the economy. So I would say that that's everybody's focus in the country. And that has brought in and propelled that growth of the country.
Well, I discovered all sorts of things about Korea as I did my research. You indeed just referred to it, and I read about the miracle on the Han, and of course, Korea remains one of the fastest growing developing nations in the world. But your education, I want to just pause on that, because you have a BA in International Economics from the University of Seoul, which of course, quite rightly, took you and welcomed you. But then you went and got an MBA from Stanford. And I wondered in the world of PE how each of those has helped you.
I don't think I had a private equity career in mind. I'd be lying. You know, in 1990s, particularly in Asia, private equity was an unknown word. Like, people didn't know about it. Even when I went to business school, it was not well known. Private equity players were not coming on campus for recruiting, as you can imagine. I majored economics in Seoul National University. I mean, Seoul National University is the best university in the country. Lots of country leaders come out of that. I was privileged to be able to be educated in that university in economics, because I thought that business is something that moves the world and moves the economy and changes people's lives. And that's something that I want to learn. I think my journey, particularly at the beginning, it's led by where can I learn the most? And that is driven by my curiosity. So after undergrad, as a CPA, I worked as an auditor and I worked at a consulting company. I wanted to see what's out there in the world. So business school was a good opportunity for me. That was a 2 years of really researching and understanding what I can do next. I wouldn't say that even at the business school, as I said, I knew about private equity. It all came in as I was thinking about investing is something that I want to do. And I was like naively thinking investing is actually stock market investing. So I applied to asset management firms and all of those. And then I got to learn about private equity through some strange incident. And you might find this really interesting. So back in 2000, when I was in business school, that was the first time that internet was being rolled out and email was being rolled out. So by being at Stanford, Google actually uses Stanford Business School students as a beta tester for Gmail. So if you look at my Gmail address, it's exactly my name and at gmail.com. And at that time, the Wall Street Journal, at the end of the year, they had a 10 most surprising event in the world that happened back in 2000. I think the number one thing at that year was about the email, the power of the email. And the power of the email was proven by one email that's related to private equity industry that some junior person at Carlyle in South Korea had an email out to his friend talking about how great being a private equity investor in South Korea, that all the chicks are after him. He's living like a king. That email actually got circulated twice around the world within 24 hours. But without the email, that would not have been possible. And I heard about Carlyle and the private equity through that email. So I put that on my list. I sent an email out to apply to Carlyle in Washington for the U.S. fund. And then they referred me to the Asia fund when they were first starting their Carlyle Asia fund. So that's how I got into the private equity industry.
Well, that is an interesting story. And I heard, just to tack on to that, that when you were at Carlyle, you might have been the first female in private equity in your office. And that one night you were working late and one of the cleaners came by and said, "Secretaries don't have to work this late." So I thought you must have to have had a sense of humor.
Yes, that was a very memorable event. And I didn't really notice, but I was told by others that there wasn't any private equity female professional in South Korea at that time. So that was early 2000. At that time, we didn't even actually have this powerful model and that you send an email. You couldn't send actually the entire LBO model to your investment committee. So I remember working overnight, printing out all my LBO model and then faxing them to our investment committee in the US. And of course, the fax breaks down and things like that. So I was like staying overnight, like late at night. And by the time the cleaning lady came in the morning, she's like, "My secretary is working so late." Or like, what have you been doing here?
So from Carlyle, I know you passed through Ontario Teachers for a while, and we had Joe Taylor, the CEO, on in our first series, and you land up at CPP. For people who don't know, you're responsible for PE globally, which in itself has been a fascinating series of steps, which we'll cover. But let's just start high-level CPP. Why does it exist, and what is its purpose?
So CPP Investment is a global professional investment manager that exclusively manages National Pension, which is Canada Pension Plan. It was set up at the end of 1990s, and then to be able to manage the pension assets only versus many other pensions, they do administrative parts as well as asset management parts. So we are just an asset manager for Canada Pension Plan. We only have one mandate, which is to maximize the returns per risk that we're taking. And our critical purpose is to provide the financial security for our 21 million Canadian contributors and beneficiaries. We're very professionally managed and are led by our very professional board of directors.
And I think if I'm right, and I've got my Canadian dollar exchange rate correct, the organization's managing over $400 billion US dollars, which is whatever that is, 570 billion Canadian. I might be slightly out of touch. And I read the annual report, and your CEO, John Graham, made a comment that I just wanted to start with. He said, "CPP's investment approach is underpinned by its prudent investment strategy designed to create value for generations." Now, we talk about PE a lot. What does prudence mean in the context of private equity?
I think John's comment goes across all the strategies, and it goes across, I think, total portfolio. And then when you look at the prudent, as I mentioned, our goal is to maximize returns per risk that we're taking. So what it means for the private equity, we look at actually diversification within our private equity portfolio, but more importantly, also as a whole fund portfolio as well.
Okay, so let's stay with the private equity activities. I think that there's always a lack of clarity because people are typically less familiar than the public markets about how you source ideas. So just help us understand that whatever the geography, how do these ideas come across your desk?
Yeah, that's a great point, Simon, because private investments, I tell our team all the time that unlike public markets, the sourcing is key. It's a private investment. It's not out there, the securities out there that you can buy when you want to buy. So number one, identifying the companies that you like to buy and then having the meeting of the minds that sellers are willing to sell, which means that private equity requires lots of groundwork, lots of feet on the ground to be able to make any transactions happen and then to be able to build the portfolios.
So could you give us an example so we can sort of almost visualize this timeline of one of the transactions that have taken place on your watch, whichever geography it is, how it came about, and what were the next few steps?
We not only source through identifying companies directly, but very important part of our sourcing channel is through our general partners, so private equity fund partners. So you can imagine our private equity fund partners as one of the largest private equity investors globally. They have network around the world with the people around the world running around to be able to source the best potential investment targets. And then we work very closely with them to be able to access those opportunities. It doesn't have to be the ones that's coming new. It could also be the ones that our private equity partners already own. So our team has great access and information on the portfolio companies that our general partner funds own. And oftentimes we monitor those for multiple years. And then think of the companies that we like to own for long term.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsor. Earlier this year, I spoke to David Neal, CEO of IFM Investors, who shared the firm's strategy and mission to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of 120 million working people. We're pleased to now be sponsored by IFM Investors, who are owned by pension funds and inspired by their members. They were set up in Australia 30 years ago, and today have a truly global footprint, operating across 11 cities and employing over 600 people. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. They're a responsible and long-term investor too, actively engaging with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, helping to improve performance whilst minimizing risk. Please tap the link in the episode description to learn more. So that begs the next question, which is when you are looking for these opportunities, you have an idea thematically or geographically of the industries that you are particularly looking at. And today, what would you say are perhaps the three most important priorities in terms of the things that you are hoping to source for in the next year?
Simon, maybe stepping back a little bit, maybe I can introduce a little bit about our CPP Investments private equity program. I joined CPP Investments 17 years ago. We've been having private equity as a strategy for almost two decades. We started investing in North America. We expanded out to Europe. We expanded out to Asia. So we're a global investor. I have about 150 billion Canadian, so about 110 billion US dollars of private equity portfolio, which makes us one of the largest private equity players in the world. I have 175 investment professionals, very strong investment professionals, experienced investment professionals in private equity around the world. They're based out of Toronto, New York, San Francisco, London, Hong Kong, and Mumbai. To be able to make private investments with conviction, you need to have strong knowledge about any given verticals. So over time, our direct investment team has also built their knowledge and expertise in certain verticals, including technology like enterprise software, healthcare, industries, and business services. So those are the areas we have done the deals, but we're not exclusively doing those type of deals. There are opportunities that we may look at it and that we have multiple ways to address it. By that, what I mean is I have five different strategies under private equity department that I run. I have primary fund investment, secondaries investment, direct investment, gross equity investment, and Asian investment strategy that does all of these. So sometimes it may not work out for our direct private equity team. It could go to our co-investments under funds team, or our secondary team can look at it.
As I plotted your progress, I saw that you had previously to running the whole of the PE activities for CPP, you'd been head of private equity Asia and had been responsible or instrumental in securing investment opportunities in China. Now, I think I'm right in saying that you, as an organization, made an investment in Alibaba, which I'd love to hear a bit about because it comes at this juncture where the obvious geopolitical turbulence is causing some investors to stay away, and yet some of the best value in listed markets, and I imagine that's reflected in private, but you'll tell me otherwise, is of course, you know, in China. It's the sort of kind of the elephant in the room, as Ray Dalio, who's on the show, said, you know, there is a de-risking going on in some quarters, but there isn't a decoupling. So tell me first about Alibaba, and then we can widen it out into the sort of the wider China question.
As I mentioned earlier, Asia is a market that we expanded out to also make private equity investments 17 years ago, actually, when I opened the office too. We invested in Alibaba more than 12 years ago, so when the company was private. And when the company went IPO, actually, private investment, our mandate is to invest in private companies. And then when the companies go IPO, we sell down over time. We have realized almost 10 times of our investment money. So it was one of the very successful investments in private equity. But we no longer hold it in the private investments given it's a listed company. We had a really good ride with the internet and the e-commerce ride in Asia in particular when I was running the Asia business. And then we have done some of those in other markets as well. Lots of private equity investors have made money by backing the transition of the whole economy, not only doing brick and mortar, but also moving online as well.
And today, how would you describe the risk appetite of CPP for investing in China?
I would say that Mike could be different from many other investors, and it coming from in a sense that we've been operating in that market for 17 plus years, and that we have a very strong team on the ground which understands risk and returns very well. And then being able to balance what risk you're taking and then what you need to ask as a result of that. So it's not a market that you probably want to jump in now unless you have very deep expertise. It is true that with lots of changes, particularly the regulatory changes, which is a difficult part for the investors to predict, the bar has gotten up to be able to really make sure that you check all the things and it needs to be compensated for the risk that you're taking. So we're prudently looking at the opportunities. We still have very strong team on the ground and open for making investments when we find appropriate opportunities there.
And generally, stepping back from China, Asia being this enormous, it's almost not fair to put a sort of the label of Asia because what's going on in India is quite different from what's going on in Korea or Singapore. But just give us a sense of where the investor base is in accepting and wanting private equity as part of wider institutional and even individual asset allocations.
Private equity market is very concentrated in North America, US. It is not too different from when I look at my own portfolio and CPP Investments private equity. We're almost 60% in the US and Canada, and just about more than 25%, like around 25% in Europe and around 15% in Asia. So the market is heavily concentrated in North America, and that we've seen very strong returns for the last decade in North America as well. Having said that, our Asia program has delivered very strong alpha returns. It is right now the best performing historic for the last 5 years, best performing alpha strategy in the whole investment strategy in CPP Investments. Again, I think I would say that that is because we have the team underground that understands the market really well. And in Asia, it's also the market that information is not as readily available. And if you can access that and utilize that, there's alpha that you can capture.
That's interesting. There's an information advantage if you're well established research, which I understand. Pivoting to Europe, which is sort of the problem child for many investors because of eurosclerosis, because of frustration with, you know, all of the stuff that's gone with the euro construct. How do you navigate Europe? Because you've got some sizable commitments there. And are you, for example, we had Philip Fries from KKR in Europe, incredibly upbeat and positive about the opportunities as a PE investor. So tell me, how are you viewing that?
I would say that I love private equity investing. I'm biased. It is because it is very much bottom-up investing. You need to overlay with the overall kind of macro environment And having macro headwind is really hard to generate the returns. But having said all those, it's still 80% coming from the bottom-up work that private equity does. So it's fundamentally bottom-up. And then there's still opportunities in Europe that you can find the companies that has high growth, despite the fact that macro and the overall economy may not be growing as fast. Private equity, I sometimes call that as governance arbitrage, having very strong owner that's motivated to be able to deliver, adding value year in and year out, compounding the value of the company 20, 30% annually, that really changed the game of the company. So that still provides, I think European market still provides great opportunities for that.
I'd like to talk a little bit about technology, because whilst everybody's got very excited about the Magnificent Seven, I get the sense talking to people on the ground that it's the companies, often the older companies, they're going to be the biggest beneficiaries of AI. And I wonder how you are thinking as an owner of companies about how technology more generally is being deployed by you.
I think we have huge runway coming with AI being used by many people and many companies. I mean, as you know, AI existed before as well. Now, I wouldn't pretend that I'm an AI expert or anything. But stepping back from also AI, whole digitization for the last decade or two really drove lots of returns for private equity. So when you look at it for the last decade, private equity made a great amount of money, and a big part of that driven by enterprise software. And if you ask me, the digitization is done? No, actually, there are lots of more areas that we have seen that the digitization needs to still happen. We saw that over pandemic. When pandemic happened, yes, consumers were able to order groceries. They can order things, and then, you know, Amazon delivers to your door and things. But lots of B2B areas, we saw that it's not digitized yet. And we're still in that journey, and softwares and digitization implementation support from the companies will continue to happen. And with the AI coming in, I think the speed of that, it will be much faster. I'm very excited about that as well. So I was talking to one of our board members this week over our board meeting, asking, oh, do we need to choose whether we're going to have the cost savings, like having less FTEs, like workforce, or growing the revenue? My answer was, private equity industry will probably do both. Private equity industry can probably capture the faster revenue growth through the better go-to-market strategy, as well as having less labor intensiveness for any business that can they're running as a result of having AI in our back pocket.
And is there any noticeable difference in the geographies you operate about the sort of speed of adoption?
I would say that it's more depending on the companies and the CEOs and management teams as opposed to North America and Europe or Asia and differences. And the type of business that you're running as well. Like there are very apparent use cases for example, consumer marketing. Very apparent use cases for phone, like customer service on the phone booth. So there are it's well-established user cases for certain industries. So you can probably see those things being implemented first.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsor. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. One of the big investment themes that everybody is debating, which is the green and the transition assets, which are getting a lot of headline and a lot of excitement. I think your numbers might be, if I'm right, that you've invested over $60 billion in green and in transition assets. Just tell me how, because it's different from a typical private equity business, and if it's not entirely, you have CPP go about it.
So CPP has been focusing on this for many years. You may be surprised that we first published sustainable investing report back in 2008. And then nobody probably noticed that because people are not paying attention to that. And then we've been staying on the course and continue evolving our focus on it, and that we started incorporating in our entire investment process. I know that that's a big thing now, and a lot of investors are into making that happen, but we were way ahead in doing so. By that, what I mean is, like, we didn't approach this green investing through divesting what we are holding. We had a strong view that to be able to make the difference, to be able to make the impact, we need to be the transitional investor. So we can, instead of dumping the carbon to the market and so that other people buy it, we can own it and then being a more active owner of the companies and work with the companies to reduce it as long as the company and management team are on board as well. It is easier for the private investments because oftentimes we control those or co-control with our partners. It could be a harder journey for the public markets. So having said all those, in the private equity, our mandate is to deliver, actually, when you look at the absolute returns, very high returns, and because the risk we're taking is higher. So when we look at to be able to meet the returns that's required for the private equity, I think making the heavy asset investments is not part of PE's mandate. It's not private equity's mandate. It's more of our real asset, our infrastructures and the real estate and those colleagues' work. And then they've been doing acquiring transitional assets and being able to transition those carbon-intensive businesses to more green assets.
That's a potentially interesting opportunity, isn't it? You have this withdrawal of monies from legacy energy industries because of the whole rush to decarbonize and not be associated from some quarters with the fossil fuel industry. And yet the cash flows coming out of these energy companies are prodigious. Does that actually create quite an interesting opportunity? And you sitting in Canada, which of course is one of the energy-rich countries, is that actually quite an interesting opportunity to acquire legacy assets that are increasingly unloved?
I think that's the focus, again, from our real assets department. So I wouldn't go over my ski. In private equity, what I believe makes sense is actually climate-related technologies and asset-light business. So our focus is, as part of our growth equity team that actually I set up when I took over our private equity global business, to be able to really look at what are the innovative technologies that can change the world.
How much of your time and your team's time is looking at the capital stack and the opportunities that exist in debt as opposed to equity?
When I was running the Asia business prior to taking the global head of private equity, I was responsible for across all the asset classes, including public, private equity, infrastructure, real estate, and credit. But Asia market is, for the credit, it's a relatively small market. We have long history in doing credit investments and particularly private credit investments. We started almost 17 years ago. It was part of our private investments program, now spun out to our credit investments that provides across public and private credit directly through sponsor financings. We also have a platform company that providing mid-market sponsor financing business called Antares that we acquired from GE over the financial crisis when they were getting out of the financial services business as well.
We just interviewed Manny Roman, who is the CEO of PIMCO, and he, of course, is thick in the whole debt universe, but within that was making quite a powerful case for these opportunities as refinancings take place and as banks withdraw from some of their previous activities. And there were certainly, his words were, a very target-rich environment. So you've explained the whole thrust of private equity very clearly, but if we just go back up to that total portfolio, I've noted that the returns that have been achieved, I think the 10-year annualized return has been 9.6% net. Tell me a little bit about the whole total portfolio and how you, running a very important silo, but you're part of the chessboard, how you all put this together.
That is a great question, Simon. Total portfolio approach is one of our conscious choice on how we're going to run our total fund. Our total portfolio approach is really our internally developed advantage that we have. By looking at more fundamental risk and return of any given underlying investment strategies, as opposed to just looking at the asset labels like real estate and private equity. My colleagues in total portfolio management team explains to me that this is having an X-ray vision of looking at different strategies. And that allows us to achieve our target exposures and then returns with the targeted risk levels, much more precise way. But what does that mean for the private equity team? It means on the practitioners on the ground is more flexibility because we're not given any annual target to meet. or at the end of the year, because you have certain number that you need to meet, like 20% of the portfolio or 10% of the portfolio, that you need to do something unnatural. And at any given point, we have more range of outcome that we can deliver. And then with the total portfolio approach, we can substitute with the different strategies. So that gives more flexibility to the team, which is really important. You can imagine for the illiquid investment that we talked about earlier, that you cannot buy securities whenever you want to buy, or you cannot sell the securities whenever you want to sell either. So having that flexibility, I think, is a huge advantage for our team.
I'd like to move to some general questions. In my research, I discovered a couple of intriguing things, and maybe you can shed some light. Is that one is that only 3.2% of South Koreans are overweight, which ties the country with Japan for the lowest percentage of healthy people in the world. Tell me, why are South Koreans so disciplined?
I would say it's lots of things related to the diet. People may not know that. People may think that like Koreans only have the barbecues. Very well known barbecue, and then spicy food. But there's a huge variety of food that you eat, and a big part of that is actually vegetable. And then one thing that you might find it interesting is that when you do the barbecue with a married North American husband, it's lots of meat. But actually, when Koreans do the barbecue, it always comes with vegetable. You wrap them up with the vegetables. You compensate. So it's a nice balance of having vegetables and the proteins together. I believe that's a fundamental, the diet.
Well, that will please Mike Milken, who was a guest on the show and talked about the absolute imperative of diet in curing his own cancer and in the work he's been doing around the whole field of cancer cures. The other issue which surprised me, but it's an interesting question from a business standpoint, is that I read that South Korean men love makeup and they spend close to $900 million a year and are a quarter of the world's cosmetics market. And up to 20% of the male Korean population is reported to use makeup regularly. Now, can you explain why that might be? And do you think that might be something that expands globally?
I don't know.
If you ever come back on the show, we might ask you to reflect on it further. But yeah, very interesting indeed. And that's one of the joys about doing research, you know, ahead of these conversations.
So how big is the market, you said?
So the market is close to $900 million a year, and that represents a quarter of male cosmetic sales globally.
Quarter of male cosmetic sales globally. Yeah, I think that might also have to do with the culture in Asia. It's not only Korea, but in Asia in general, that showing best of yourself, presenting yourself at your best self is very important. And I think that expands across the gender, not only female, but also male as well. That could be a good trend to catch.
Right. Well, maybe I need to just a little experimentation, much perhaps to the horror of my children. Okay, three final questions. And what's number one? Who has been your most important mentor and why?
I've been lucky to have many mentors throughout my career. I can name a number of them. Like I worked at McKinsey and on my first project, our partner for the project was Dominic Barton, who until a couple of years ago was the global managing partner of McKinsey. And I learned great deals from him, not only how to be the best consultant, but also how to be the best human being as well. And Dominic was actually the reference for me to when I first moved to Canada to get a job. And I would attribute some of the reasons why I started working at Canadian Pensions to Dominic. I've been lucky to have throughout my career managers who have been able to see the potential in me and then allow me to take bigger responsibilities. And my goal now is to be able to do that for other female professionals that I work with. That's one of the key goals that I have. And also, that's one of the things that as part of my pet project, when I see our portfolio company CEOs, I oftentimes ask, have you had a chance to compliment your female colleagues or somebody who reports to you and highly talented? And how are you helping them to reach their full potential?
Early on, Sui, one thing that came through was the clear weight you attach to curiosity. When you're interviewing candidates, what gets your attention?
When I see people's desire to learn, investing is a job, particularly I would say the private equity investing is a job that if you do more work, you get paid off. Unlike public markets where theoretically the information is level playing field. Private equity, this is one of the key reasons why I also like private equity, is that the more work you do, the more information you get, you can get more informed decisions. The level of curiosity that you have, that actually directly leads to the outcome that you could have in this asset class. So that's one thing that I really look into.
Great. That's very clear. And finally, what advice would you give to someone thinking about joining private equity? We have lots of young students who listen to the show, and we, Money Myths Podcast, now sponsors 10 finance societies at universities around the world. What's the key, the advice that they would like to hear from you?
Be open to taking risks, I would say. And that you never know what the past may lead you to. We talked about how I got into the private equity industry. Private equity industry is changing rapidly. Like when I started private equity investments versus now, it's day and night. There are many more strategies that and many more different products that's out there in the private equity players that they're offering and has evolved how they generate the returns. So don't be afraid to get into the new areas of investing that may ultimately lead you to the private equity investing. Or private investing may be very different by the time they become a partner.
Got it. See, thank you very much. We've covered a lot of ground and you've been very frank about your own journey and successes. And I always wrap up with a couple of takeaways. You've given some really important observations, two of them, which I will repeat for our audience, which resonated with me. Number one, to younger people, be open to taking risks. And the path is unknown, but can be incredibly exciting. So don't be too locked on a specific route that you think is going to be the one that takes you. And in the world of PE, the more work you do, the more information you garner, and the better decisions you are able to make. With that, Sui Kim, I know you are in Toronto this morning and it's raining and miserable, or was it snowing and you barely got into the office? So thank you for making it in, and it's been great meeting you, and look forward to meeting you in person in due course.
Thank you so much, Simon. Enjoy your time in Switzerland.
Thank you. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is true and accurate as of the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the content. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed.